the hits. I'm Nikki Strong. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Dan Friedel. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley will bring us the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, health officials are still looking for answers related to mysterious cases of severe liver damage in hundreds of young children around the world. The best available evidence points to a common stomach virus not known to cause liver problems in otherwise healthy children. That virus was found in the blood of sick children, but it has not been found in their diseased livers. Eric Krimmer is a virus researcher at the Institute of Molecular Genetics of Montpellier in France. He said, "There's a lot of things that don't make sense." The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and health officials around the world are trying to find out what is going on. The illnesses are considered rare. CDC officials recently said they are now looking into 180 possible cases across the United States. Most of the children were hospitalized. At least 15 required new livers, and 6 died. More than 20 other countries have reported hundreds more cases in total. The largest numbers have been in Britain and the U.S. Some signs of liver inflammation include fever, tiredness, loss of interest in eating, and nausea. Others include stomach pain, joint pain, and jaundice, a condition that causes a person's skin to turn yellow. Disease experts say they have been working on the mystery illness for months, but have struggled to find an exact cause. The usual causes of liver inflammation in otherwise healthy children come from viruses known as hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E. But none of those viruses appeared in tests. The children came from different places, and there seemed to be no common means of virus contact. What did show up in tests was a virus known as adenovirus 41. More than half of the U.S. cases have tested positive for adenovirus. In a small number of tests to see what kind of adenovirus was present, adenovirus 41 appeared every time. Dr. Jay Butler is the Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases at the CDC. He told the Associated Press that the fact that adenovirus keeps appearing strengthens the possibility that it plays a part in the illness. But it is still unclear how. Many adenoviruses are related to signs of the common cold, such as fever, sore throat, and pink eye. Some versions, including adenovirus 41, can cause other problems, such as inflammation in the stomach and intestines. Adenoviruses have been linked in the past to hepatitis in children but mostly in children with weakened immune systems. Dr. Umesh Parashar is head of the CDC group that studies gut diseases caused by viruses. He said recent genetic studies do not suggest that a single new version of adenovirus is to blame.
Researchers are using an underwater drone to measure carbon dioxide, CO2, levels in the ocean. It is believed to be the first time such a vehicle has been used specifically to test CO2 levels. The vehicle, which the team also calls a glider, is designed to dive down to 1,000 meters in deep ocean areas and can operate for weeks at a time. The goal of the research is to provide scientists with data about how climate change is affecting the ocean's chemistry. The self-swimming drone was deployed in the Gulf of Alaska this spring. Reporters from the Associated Press recently joined researchers on a boat in Alaska's Resurrection Bay to see the drone in action. The team says the project could be a major step forward in measuring the environmental health of oceans. The scientists are most interested in levels of ocean acidification. This happens when CO2 emissions in the atmosphere make their way into the ocean. Ocean acidification can harm or kill some kinds of sea life. Scientists have linked CO2 emissions to global warming caused by human activities. In a way, oceans have done humans a big favor by taking in some of the CO2. If this were not the case, there would be much more CO2 in the atmosphere. This would trap more of the sun's heat and further warm the earth. But the problem is now that the ocean is changing its chemistry because of this uptake, said team member Claudine Hari. She is an oceanographer with the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. One of the best ways to measure ocean acidification is to collect CO2 measurements. Until now, these collections were mostly done from ships or with floating devices at the ocean surface, or equipment on the ocean floor. Howry is working with another researcher, Andrew McDonnell, on the project. He is an oceanographer with the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences at the university. The two, who are married, teamed up in recent months with engineers from Cyprus Subsea Consulting and Services, which provided the drone. A German company, 4H Jena, supplied the CO2 sensor. The team repeatedly took the drone farther and farther into Resurrection Bay from the coastal community of Seward to carry out the tests. Researchers said the drone's sensor is like a very small laboratory. It examines CO2 data and stores it inside a temperature-controlled system. Richard Feely is a scientist with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He is stationed at the agency's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle, Washington. Feely said the goal of the project is to make the measurements collected by the glider just as accurate as those carried out on ships. Researchers in Canada have also tested a smaller CO2 measuring device attached to a drone. But that sensor has not yet met effective targets for ocean acidification observations. McDonnell said his goal is to one day have a large number of similar robotic gliders operating in oceans across the world. Such efforts will be important in helping scientists understand much more about what's going on in the ocean than we have before, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Much of gardening is learned by trial and error. That means from mistakes. We have all been in that situation. The good news is we can learn from other people's mistakes and our own. Associated Press garden writer Jessica Damiano has this advice. First, we need to admit we're not perfect. Many years ago, Damiano planted some morning glory seeds near the front gate of her garden. The seeds are often called a fast grower and self-sower. She was sure the vine would immediately bloom with leaves and flowers. But the morning glory did its job too well. She now spends about a half hour every week during summer pulling up seedlings that grow as far as 15 meters away. Damiano said that was not her only trial and error in gardening. One summer, she planted some mint in a garden bed instead of a container. But the mint jumped at the garden bed and spread everywhere. By the third year, Damiano had to dig up the whole bed to remove it. She learned not to plant invasive plants. Here is a list of Damiano's 5 common gardening mistakes with advice on how to avoid them. Having the right pH level, a measure of acidity, for the soil is important for gardening success. Tomatoes, for example, grow best in soil with a pH between 6.0 and 6.8. Blueberry plants, however, will likely turn yellow and produce little if the pH is higher than 5.5. That is because nutrients are available to plants only at target pH levels, which are different for each kind of plant. Test kits for pH are not costly, and you should test the soil in each garden bed individually. The pH level is often not the same in different parts of the garden. A reading of 7.0 is considered neutral. A lower number means the soil is acidic, and a higher number means it is a base. it is best to select plants that do well in your garden conditions. Most garden plants require 2.5 to nearly 4 centimeters of water weekly. The water could come from rainfall or from your home. Mold, mildew, and bacterial diseases, however, could spread if too much water becomes trapped between plant parts. Too much water can spread these problems from infected leaves to healthy ones. Make sure to direct water to roots where it is needed. Avoid watering leaves, fruit, and flowers. Compost, made of food or plant waste, is a gardener's best friend. It improves the drainage of heavy clay soil, increases the water-holding ability of sand, and adds high-quality nutrients. Add compost into new beds and borders, or add an amount equal to half the removed soil to individual planting holes. A plant that needs full sun will likely disappoint if planted in an area without sunshine. The same is true the other way around. And do not put drought-tolerant plants or plants that can survive long periods without water in poorly draining, soggy soil. Choose the plants that are right for your growing conditions. The result will be a better-looking, healthier garden that requires less care and less work. Mulch is material made out of old leaves, wood, or compost. It can keep water and heat in the soil. It also suppresses unwanted plants or weeds. So, it is an important part of every garden. Mulching incorrectly, however, can kill your plants. Always use mulch from natural materials such as tree bark, wood chips, straw, or pine needles. They enrich the soil as they break down. Add 5 to 7 centimeters of mulch around plants several times a year. Keep the material about 7 centimeters away from trunks and stems to avoid blocking air and preventing water from escaping, which would result in rot. I'm Dan Friedel.
National Parks journey takes us to the western state of Colorado. There, you will find a 77-kilometer-long canyon. Its exposed rocks are among the oldest you will find on Earth. The canyon is so narrow and so deep that sunlight shines only briefly at the bottom at midday. That frequent darkness is what has given this canyon its name. Welcome to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park.
Black Canyon seems impossibly steep and narrow. The fast-moving Gunnison River formed the canyon over millions of years. As the river flows through the canyon, it drops an average of 18 meters per kilometer. The Gunnison River loses more elevation in its 77-kilometer canyon stretch than the Mississippi River does in 2,400 kilometers from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. This loss in elevation causes the river to gain speed and force. Over time, that force has carved and cut the hard rock and created the wild and jagged rock formations found at Black Canyon. That process is known as erosion.
Black Canyon attracted little attention from early Western explorers. In fact, no early Spanish explorers to the southwestern United States reported seeing Black Canyon. The first written record about the canyon came in 1873. The Ute Indians certainly knew of Black Canyon, but only its rim, never the gorge, shows evidence of past human occupation. Even today, the depth and steepness of Black Canyon make it extremely difficult for humans to access.
Birds, however, have no problem surviving in the canyon environment. Black Canyon is home to many kinds of birds. They live at the canyon rim, along its walls, and by the river. Mountain bluebirds and great horned owls live in the rim area. The owls eat seeds and berries from the pinyon, juniper, and oak trees found there. Canyon wrens sing loudly within Black Canyon. Visitors are more likely to hear the birds than see them. They build their nests on flat surfaces of the canyon walls. So do peregrine falcons. They prey on other birds. They dive at speeds up to 300 kilometers per hour to catch them. American dippers build their nests in the gorge next to the Gunnison River. A gorge is a narrow valley between hills or mountains. These dippers feed on insects and small fish.
Some people come to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park for world-class bird watching. But it is the canyon itself that appeals to most visitors. Walking along the rim, seeing the canyon's towering cliffs, and hearing the powerful flow of the Gunnison River far below is an overwhelming experience. At Black Canyon, visitors can view some of the planet's oldest exposed rocks. They are Precambrian rocks. Precambrian accounts for the Earth's history from its very beginning up until about 540 million years ago. Precambrian rocks are described as basement rocks because they are usually buried deep under the surface. They only become exposed when younger rocks have been cut away by erosion or other forces. At Black Canyon, the Gunnison has eroded the canyon walls so greatly that Precambrian rocks have become visible. Often, the canyon's rock walls look like works of art. Different kinds of rocks fold together and form colorful patterns. The patterns change as sunlight hits different parts of the walls. One area of the canyon is known as Painted Wall. It is the highest cliff in Colorado. Long pink bands of rock cover this section of the canyon, as if a person took a paintbrush to the wall. This pattern formed as hot liquid from below the Earth's surface forced its way into rock cracks. As it slowly cooled, large crystals formed. The bands get their pink color from a crystallized mineral called potassium feldspar.
Local people knew just how special Black Canyon was. They began urging Congress to protect the canyon in the 1930s. It became a national monument in 1933. And in 1999, it became a national park. The park protects more than 22 kilometers of the canyon. Most visitors spend their time exploring the canyon rim by foot or by car. Several kilometers of trails lead to many overlook points. A road also leads to several breathtaking views. The U.S. Congress named the lands below the canyon rim a wilderness preservation system. This is meant to protect forever the land's natural conditions.
Some adventurous travelers choose to explore this wilderness by hiking down to the inner canyon. There are no marked trails to guide them. Hikers must first get a wilderness use permit. These permits are free, but only a limited number are available each day. Many of the paths are difficult to follow. Some are also dangerous. The Warner Point Trail, for example, drops more than 820 meters. Walking down takes more than 2 hours. Walking back up can take up to 4 hours. The Park Service warns that poison ivy grows wildly in the inner canyon. There is also the risk of falling rocks. But to reach a place where no humans ever tried to live is the reward. In the words of a 1901 explorer to Black Canyon's river area, "Our surroundings were of the wildest possible description. The roar of the water was constantly in our ears. Occasionally, a rock would fall from one side or the other with a roar and a crash, exploding like a ton of dynamite when it struck bottom, making us think our last day had come." I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.